I'm talking from San Francisco, which is as good a place as any, and perhaps better than most, to escape from the eastern view of the presidential election. The view not so much of what happened as of what was going to happen. For the East, the Northeast, is the headquarters of the four television networks and the home of the pollsters. And there has rarely been an election in which all the polls, including the ones undertaken by two TV networks in association with two distinguished Eastern newspapers, in which all the polls were so much in agreement about the outcome. It was going to be so tight that on the eve of the election, they, with one exception, announced that it was too close to call. The exception decided at the last moment that there was a swing to Reagan that might give him as much as 4 or even 5% lead over Carter in the popular vote. In the outcome, it was 10%. And even if you add John Anderson's vote to Carter's, you still come out with an absolute Reagan majority of 3 millions in over 83 millions. Why were they all so disastrously wrong? It's a question that's going charitably unanswered in the euphoria of the Republicans and the depression of the Democrats. It seems to me worth risking one answer, which might persuade the pollsters next time to change their tactics. They concentrate to the point of obsession on the popular vote, that is, on the totals likely to vote one way or another. But the presidency is never decided by the total popular vote of the whole country. It's decided by the majorities of the popular vote in each state. And since the states have a vastly different apportionment of votes in the Electoral College, it is the distribution of the popular vote, not its mass, which chooses the president. Let me simplify the working of the Electoral College by asking you to imagine that 10 boys in the top form of a school are going to vote for head prefect. If every boy had one vote, then, obviously, whoever got 6 votes would win. But suppose that a different number of votes was assigned to each boy through some consideration of age, experience, or length of stay in the school, so that one boy has 6 votes, another 4, 4 more have 2 votes, and the rest 1 each. This would add up to a total of 22 electoral votes. The winner would need 12 votes, and he could get them from only 3 boys in the 10. That's the way the Electoral College works. Each state, according to its population, has so many congressmen, members of the House of Representatives, and each state, huge or tiny, has 2 senators. The electoral vote of every state is the number of its congressmen plus the 2 senators. So that California, with 43 congressmen and 2 senators, has 45 electoral votes. New York has 39 congressmen, 2 senators, 41. Wyoming, a physically large state but sparsely populated, has only 1 congressman and 2 senators, 3 electoral votes, and so on. So, to begin with, the pollsters' maps of the United States showing practically the whole of the West painted blue as going for Reagan was deceptive. He won Arizona, Nevada, Montana, Wyoming, Oregon, Utah, Idaho, and the state of Washington. But altogether that gave him only 39 electoral votes. If he'd lost California with its 45 electoral votes, he would have been 6 votes down in the whole far West. He didn't, however, so the West came in with a handsome 84 electoral votes for him. Now, the pollsters agree with the pundits that any presidential election turns on the popular vote in 9 big states, the big meaning the most populous states, which, their size apart, hold the most electoral votes. And they are California, New York, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Texas, Ohio, Michigan, Florida, and New Jersey. Together, they have 245 electoral votes, only 25 short of the majority needed to win. If you add Indiana and Mizora, you'd get 270. So it would have been possible for Reagan, or Carter, to win the election by getting a majority of the popular vote in 11 states, while the loser took the other 39 states. Well, Reagan took the 11 I mentioned and was already the winner. In the result, he took 44 states, and Carter took 6 states and the District of Columbia, the home of the capital city. If you want to write an even more sinister scenario, as we now say, you could imagine a tight race everywhere, in which 11 voters, literally 11 human beings, by having a change of mind as they went into the polling booth, could switch the election from one presidential candidate to his opponent, because the whole electoral vote of any state goes to the man who has a majority, however minute, of the popular vote. And if that sounds like a ludicrous possibility, let me remind you that in the election of 1960, when over 60 million people voted, a switch of only 40,000 votes in chosen states could have sent Richard Nixon, and not John F. Kennedy, to the White House. My suggestion is simply that next time the pollsters spend more time taking more and more accurate samplings of the voters' mood in those 9 big states, instead of piling all the projected votes of the 50 states into 2 lump sums. There was no sign this time of a close call in any of the big 9. In California, Reagan had a majority over Carter of 1.5 million. In Texas, 700,000. Florida, 600,000. Illinois, 400,000. Pennsylvania, 250,000. Ohio, 450,000. New Jersey, 300,000. Michigan, 250,000. New York, 160,000. The pollsters might also keep reminding themselves that there have been 3 so-called minority presidents. That's to say, presidents who did not get a majority of the popular vote, but what they got in the right places. It was, no question, a famous, and for the pollsters, a humiliating victory. And yet, only 26 qualified Americans in 100 voted for Reagan. That's because only half of the registered voters took the trouble to vote, the lowest turnout in nearly 30 years. So without taking anything away from Reagan's astounding massacre of Carter, 489 electoral votes to 49, we have to be disturbed by the thought that the mandate which he and the Republicans claim is a mandate conferred on him by only 1 American in 4, a fact that could threaten all sorts of turmoil and in some poor quarters could stimulate a revival of the violent protests of the 1960s. We had a nasty harbinger of this the day after the election, when across the bay from here on the Berkeley campus of the University of California, 2,000 students gathered in a noisy though peaceable rally and chanted belligerent slogans against the man they loved to hate, the most grisly of which was 2468, we know who to assassinate. That, I hasten to say, was the low point in protest or comment anywhere in the United States. But some hint of the rather raw emotions that have been let loose can be seen in the first cartoons drawn by the half dozen or so first-rate political cartoonists with which the United States is presently blessed. One showed a Reagan got up in cowboy chaps with his hands on 2 guns sticking out of his side pockets. The caption said simply, "Back in town." The San Francisco Chronicle, which takes advantage of the wit of Oliphant, the Washington Star's resident cartoonist, showed the other day 3 recognizable grotesques with outspread arms tumbling in ecstasy down a mountainside and headed for us. They were in front Reagan and behind him, buoyed up by the roaring wind and the clattering boulders, Dr. Kissinger and Richard Nixon. The caption was one word, landslide. I ought to say that people are talking in stage whispers about the possibility of former President Nixon being offered a post in the Reagan administration. Somebody dared to suggest to one of Mr. Reagan's campaign aides that Mr. Nixon himself might be thinking that way. The aide put paid to that, I think, with an acid retort. If he is, he must be hallucinating. But whether the people out here are happy with Reagan or sorrowful with Carter, they have one grievance against the president, which is shared by the other Western states that lie in the fourth time zone of the United States, 3 hours behind the eastern seaboard. This is an angry and by now well-aired protest against the president's going on the air to concede the election 2 hours before the polls had closed out here. It was an astonishing, and in President Carter, an uncharacteristic gaffe, a blunder both of tactics and manners. It seems that the White House decided, after less than an hour of the television coverage, that the election was lost. NBC has been bitterly criticized for coming out within that hour and positively announcing Reagan as the winner. But the president himself was ready to jump the gun on NBC and take the initiative. He was restrained, but when he did concede, his aides said he thought it would be a simple, manly thing to do. Evidently, it didn't occur to any of them that there was an hour of polling still left in the mountain states and 2 hours in the far west. There doesn't appear to be much question that many thousands of voters, seeing the president make his concession speech on television, took off their coats and stayed home. They may not thereby have affected the presidential vote, but senators and congressmen who lost narrowly out west were quick to blame the president. The upshot has been two proposed bills in the House and one from a California senator in the Senate proposing that the voting times across the country be synchronized so that New York, for instance, would vote from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. and California would vote from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., all the states closing the polls at the same time. I should guess that these bills will be quickly shelved. They present awkward complications and a prospective barrage of complaints from farmers, office workers, night workers, to go no further.